Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience around the world. I'm feeling really good today. I was struggling for quite some time with a virus, and it's gone now, and I've got my energy back, and I'm chugging along and feeling as well as I have in a very long time. It's come just in time for spring here in upstate New York. And I hope any of you out there who are struggling with illnesses will have a speedy recovery from them. Thank you for listening. Thank you so much for listening. You are on PRN.FM. If you're listening from someplace and don't know who in the world's going here and where you got this, this is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and we are on www.prn.fm, internet radio. You can call in 888-874-4888 to talk, to answer questions, to do wonderful things like that. And in particular, this coming Wednesday, the next Wednesday online, which should be about the 29th or so, is the last of the week, the month. So that's open mic. There, I welcome you to ask me about anything. I may not answer it, too personal, but ask about anything. Comment on anything. Talk about anything. We ask you to be more selective during the rest of the month when I have wonderful guests on, and ask you to please address your stuff to them. And don't forget, all the shows are archived. You can get to them on Breggin.com, my website. And on that website, you can sign up and stay in touch with me at frequent alerts, free frequent alerts. Just find out what I'm doing and find out about some of the breaking news in the psychiatric reform movement. And then don't forget that my assistant Ian and I and Ginger, we all chuck in and as into the daily breaking news, the fresh breaking news. So this new stuff on the website, almost every day or every other day or every few days is frequent alerts, and just about every day there's daily breaking news, stuff you're going to be interested in. It's not just going to be critical of psychiatry. It's going to be about how to live life, just stuff we pick up here and there that we think gives an insight into better living and also into the hazards of the general psychiatric approach. And also, don't forget about the app. There's an app. You can go find an app. I'd have to ask Ginger to do it, but go find an app, and you can listen to PRN anytime, wherever you are. My guest today, Jeffrey, are you there in Australia?
I am here, Peter.
Good. You're a little faint. Raise your voice.
Okay, that's because...
Yeah, much better.
Is
yes?
Is any better now?
Oh, yeah, you're perfect now. My guest, I am so happy to have on the show. I mean, I'm really happy to have on the show, is my old friend Jeffrey Mason, M-A-S-S-O-N. I had no idea that I hadn't had Jeffrey on since 2015, Jeff, when I went back and looked, because I so enjoyed those shows with you. We had a series of four shows talking about all kinds of aspects of psychiatry, psychology, and life. Jeffrey turned the... well, let me tell you a little about Jeff. Jeffrey got his degrees, because he hasn't been on a long time, and some of you may not know who he is. He got an undergraduate degree at Harvard, and then he got a PhD in Sanskrit at Harvard. And then he became interested in psychoanalysis, and he got a psychoanalysis. I think he was in Toronto at the time, a training analysis, and decided that this was not for him. Not only did it have its grave flaws, the whole idea of therapy, but it especially wasn't for him. And I admire Jeffrey too in admitting that that being an empathic therapist could not be taught, and it just wasn't him. And how many people are out there who are actually dangerous to their patients and don't say, hey, this is not for me. How many people do that? How many people find their way into a lucrative field and say, this is not the best use of me and my skills and my abilities. I'm going to take to something else better. Well, during this process, Jeffrey rose up high in the ranks of psychoanalysis, and he was actually the head of the Freud Archives, which is we might get into today or in a few weeks. And we might have Jeff on for a lot if he doesn't get bored. And in that process, he came across letters that Sigmund Freud wrote that Anna had kept stuffed into a cabinet somewhere, a desk, that made very, very clear that Freud early on realized that the patients he was seeing had in fact been sexually abused. They weren't making it up, that it was common, and that it was happening to nearly all of the women that he was seeing. And that was his view, and he began to discuss it, and he ran into, of course, horrible rejection at the hands of his colleagues. And he very quickly, and I'd like Jeff to elaborate on this, among many other things that we'll talk about, and very quickly, Freud changed his mind and blamed it on the psyche of the children, that they lusted after their parents and made up these stories. What an outrage against humanity, Freud, like so many other men and women, and have done over so many generations. But this was just one of the more colossal outrages and got him so much enmity, along with another book he wrote, Against Therapy, which the more I read it, and I felt a little bit irritated, and then I felt a little bit anxious, and then I felt a little bit nervous, and then I felt, you know, he's right. He is right. What do we do about this situation where you can't train empathy? And how do you select for empathy? And taking it a step further, you know, what is licensing? How can you license talk? I mean, that's another thing we could get into today or tomorrow or another day. There's so much to talk about with Jeffrey. Well, and here's another thing we could talk about with Jeff, and that is that after writing a few of these books and realizing how one gets treated for attacking even things as remote from reality as the psychoanalytic movement, and of course for attacking psychiatry, which wants to control reality, he just did what maybe I should have done. I don't know. He just said, I've had enough of this. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm a writer. The result is that Jeffrey picked the subject that he loved the most and has been writing about it ever since, and it's animals and animal-human relationships. And Jeff, I think I've read more of your books than anyone else out there who's a writer. I love your books, and one of them, Dogs Never Lie About Love, this wonderful book, insightful into animals, into love. Very, very good. When Elephants Weep, I mean, these two are bestsellers. They bring out humanity and they bring out the genuine spirituality. That's maybe what to say about creatures that we like to consider lesser. Beasts, amazing book, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origin of Good and Evil. Jeff and I, since getting together again and chatting, we've been mulling over evil and why are people so bad? Jeff and I come from very, almost extremely different, extremely different political views, and yet we don't really. We both see the world very clearly. It's what to do about it politically that just gets so messy. I recommend just reading Jeffrey's books. One I haven't read or just looked at a little bit. Listen to this title, Jeffrey's a Vegan, The Face on Your Plate. How is that to inspire you to think a little differently about your food? So Jeff and I, Jeffrey helped me get in, because he reads and speaks German, into studying further the role of psychiatry in Nazi Germany, and we carried out some studies together, and then we both went to, were invited to speak at the first and maybe only medical conference in Europe on medicine in the Third Reich. It was before the Berlin Wall came down. And because of Jeff and his courage and his teaching himself to speak German, we were able, you know, to go into this strange underground subway that went from East West Berlin to East Berlin, and to rise up on the other side into hell, into the dreariest place in the world at the time that I could imagine going to, which was East Berlin before the wall came down. And I remember thinking, this place is just a state mental hospital. The USSR has turned this giant, hundreds of millions of people into inmates of a state mental hospital. So, Jeff, welcome to the show. I must never talk this much about a guest. It's really good to have you here. Hi.
Well, Peter, you're amazing. I mean, I have to say, listening to you talk about me, it's not that I didn't recognize myself, but I've never had anyone talk about me in such a positive sense, and I'm overwhelmed. I think you're just amazing.
Well, Jeff, you know, you constantly address things nobody wants to hear, and even in your animal books, I didn't want to hear. Oh, I want to tell this little story about you and your wonderful wife. She's a pediatrician, folks, and Lila, and maybe Jeff will tell you something about her. I think we'll need a few shows, Jeff, if you'll come back. But it was Thanksgiving dinner, and we had invited Jeff and his wife to come have dinner with us at a lake house that we had at the time in Northern Virginia. I lived in D.C. with Gingy. And I said to Jeff, is it okay if we make a turkey? I know you're vegetarian, but Gingy really wants a turkey. And Jeff said something like this: well, it's okay if you have a turkey, if you don't mind my sweet wife breaking down and weeping for the whole afternoon over the death of such a and eating of such a magnificent animal. Do you remember that?
I do. And I remember these were the early days when so-called fake meat, or meat that was not made from an animal, was just beginning. And we brought something along called tofurkey. And I have to admit, it was pretty bad. It was just a lump of tofu. And you, Peter, and Ginger, you looked at that, and your faces went ashen. You took a taste. You said, I'm not. You got up, and I couldn't blame you.
Was I mean about it? I can't remember, because I certainly didn't want to deal with what I do now, which is basically a plant-based diet. I was not. I mean, I was generations behind you on eating issues. But I hope, what did I do, Jeff? I don't remember my part. I just remember that wonderful statement you made on the phone to me about having a turkey.
You said, no way, I'm not eating this. And we had to laugh. I couldn't blame you. It was really terrible tasting. This was a long time ago. So I wrote a book called The Pig Who Sang to the Moon, about the emotional world of farm animals, that is, you know, cows and pigs and chickens and goats and bunny rabbits and all the animals that live on a farm, and how deeply they feel, the friendships they have, and how terrible it is to think that these animals are slaughtered just so we could eat them. So at that point, my wife and I both gave up dairy, anything made with cow's milk and eggs. We were already vegetarian, so that made us vegan. And this was, what is it now, 17 years ago. So it wasn't that common then. Now it's very, very popular, and millions of people all over the world are going to a plant-based diet, A, because it's healthier for them, B, because it's very good for the planet, and C, because it's better for the animals. So that was right after you and I, Thanksgiving, right after I had turned vegan. And I'm afraid that the food that was on offer was not the best. So you were very kind about it. I'm so pleased to see now that you too, for your health or for whatever other reason, are turning to plant-based food.
Well, I always thought on some level it was wrong to eat animals. I mean, the being I was closest to in my childhood was my dog. He was a great big dog. He must have been a cross between a lab and something larger than a lab, black lab, because I mean, he could put his head on the kitchen table and he could grab a basketball in his mouth and run off the court with it. And I always thought that this was just something that I would leave to my next lifetime, you know, just putting it off in whatever BS way I could. And I'm still eating some meat. You know, we still use some for flavoring, occasionally I eat some Pacific salmon, wild caught. So I'm still struggling with the last remnants of it. But I know in my heart, the way I feel about creatures, that I got to take the final step someday. But I mean, you know, I better hurry up, right? But I wish I'd caught on real early with you. Ginger and I would have saved a lot of health issues which we didn't need to have and which we've gotten rid of, you know, from Ginger's ulcerative colitis and, I had multiple things that went away after, and of course the weight loss is healthier and that encourages you to exercise. So the whole thing has been, better. And I think you've done a huge amount of good for humanity with your books, about animals, both in terms of loving animals and in terms of vegetarianism. I'm sure you've done a huge amount of good. You probably get good feedback from those folks, don't you?
Yes, I do indeed. I do. I didn't in the beginning, of course, but I do now. When I first wrote When Elephants Weep, scientists were not willing to acknowledge that animals had profound emotions. That has changed completely now. And I don't believe there are many people who work with animals who would not be willing to say, of course, they probably have the same feelings that we do, or maybe that are ours. By the way, I was glad to hear you say that about dogs, because that's how I first got into it. I was so close, and I'm sure that at least half of the people listening to this have been close to a dog or a cat or some other animal, sometimes a bird, sometimes even a wild animal, and they realize that of course they must be. Of course they must be.
Jeff, the connection isn't very good at this moment, Jeff.
Why would I kill them to eat them when I don't have to?
Yeah, Jeff, your connection is kind of breaking up a bit. Can you do anything on your end? I understand that's the connection to Australia via phone is what I'm being told from my instant messaging with the studio. Is there a place you could go to with the phone that might be a little better?
Gee, unfortunately, I'm in the living room here. It is an iPhone. We don't have any other phone here. That's the only phone we have. Maybe I'm holding it wrong. Let me see. I'm trying to speak into the microphone. Is that any better now?
I think you sound a little better right now. Yeah, yeah. All right, we'll keep it, like you're a rock star, you know, with the microphone. Keep your mouth right on it, and I think we'll probably do better. Some of it is just odd vibrations that I think are electronics. Jeff, tell me about...
Peter, I'm going to try and put on a headphone and see if that helps, okay?
What are you going to do?
I'm going to give me 1 second.
Okay. So we're giving Jeffrey... We're talking with Jeffrey Mason in Australia. Mason. Read his books about psychiatry. Read his books about animals. They're all interesting and thoughtful, very academic, and yet they sell well. He's a great writer. Jeffrey's a beautiful writer. I have a couple of friends whom I'm envious of. I'm a good practical writer, but I don't pay enough attention to it to write beautifully. I don't know that I ever could write the way Jeff does. Are you there?
Now, Peter, I've just put on headphones. Does this help at all?
It might. It might be helping a little bit. I don't know why, but it might be. PRN is typing, so they may have something to say to me in a second about it. But even if you're breaking up, it's well to have you on. And maybe we can figure out something for the next time you come on.
Yes.
One of the things that... there's so many things. Do you have some idea where you want to go? I'm looking at six topics. What would you like to continue about at this point?
Well, I'm just amazed that you're able to do this at your age, because I'm 5 years younger than you, and although I've never had a health issue, I think thanks to being plant-based for 17 years, I don't have your energy. I don't know where you find that, Peter. You do so much. You take on so many people, and even, I guess what I really want to ask you is, how do you find the courage to go on when so many people are opposed to you? I remember when I first started talking against psychiatry, there was an overwhelming number of people who told me to stop it. And I thought, but I'm telling the truth. I remember I was in France, and my book, The Assault on Truth, sold about 10 copies in all of France, but I was on the radio every day there for a few weeks, and a young woman who was a very, very fine journalist came up to me and said, "Have you ever heard of Peter Bragan?" And I said, "No, I haven't." She said, this was 1984, said, "Well, you better find out about him, because he's going to be the only person right now anywhere who will talk to you and who knows more about this topic than you can imagine." So I want to know how you deal with having so many people who feel you're an enemy, even though you don't even know these people, and all you're trying to do is tell the truth as you know it. You're being as honest as you can be. I feel I don't have any hatred in my heart. I'm not angry at anybody. I'm just trying to discover what is true. But I got so much blowback from the psychiatric profession, from the psychoanalytic profession. I have to say that I had very close friends who were psychoanalysts, and when I published The Assault on Truth, they would cross the street rather than say hello to me. They would not talk to me. Finally, I collared one and I said, "What is this? You and I were friends, we're the same people. Just because I disagree about the history of psychoanalysis, you won't speak to me?" And he said, "Look, Jeff, I have a career. I want to become a training analyst. If I'm seen talking to you, I won't get that position. So I'm very sorry I can no longer speak to you." And it puzzled me. Now, you've gotten this a lot more than I have, because you're much more out there. You're more of a public figure. You've been involved in many, many lawsuits where you've prevailed. And I think this must drive some members of the profession completely wild. But you also are surrounded by a number of people who believe in you, who care for what you do and support you. Is that right, Peter?
Well, from early on, I guess it was just instinctive. Whenever I found anyone who supported me, I supported them, and I asked them to join my advisory council. And, I mean, I rarely even do it anymore. Because it's just so big and such a part of me, and to support me in any way they could. But, Jeff, I don't have the answers to any of your questions. First of all, this energy level that I have, because I notice, I'm now recovering from this virus, and I'm darn near fully recovered, unknown virus, but I still outwork 30, 40-year-old lawyers when we're working together. I'm out of town. We got a trial coming up. I mean, I'm still reviewing at 10 p.m. at night, and oh, my God, I'm exhausted. It is not a choice. It's no more a choice than being a good runner or but it's not even training. Whereas a good runner, you train. It's just the way I am, and a number of my clients over the years, actually very few, but a few have said sort of that they felt bad, that they didn't choose to have all this energy that I have. And I said, it's not a choice. I didn't make some moral choice that I'm superior to you. And I frankly said the energy is a blessing and a curse because I can't necessarily turn it off either. So my brain will wake me up at 3 a.m. and say, hey, boy, get up. Get downstairs. Here's a whole bunch of thoughts for you.
Well,
so it's just the way I am.
I mean, you're right. I think it's a talent. I think you're born with it. It's a gift. Thank God you've got it, and you can use it. I must say that I'm doing something very different. My wife is a pediatrician, and she works from home, and she sees 8 children every day here in the house. And I'm proud to say that I am a receptionist, and I love it. I enjoy it. We live in a beautiful place right next to the beach, and I offer them soy cappuccinos. I take them down to the garden where Lila has a small office, and every day I make her lunch, and then we walk down to the beach and jump into the water. It's now the end of fall here, but it's still warm enough to swim. Yesterday we jumped into the ocean. And I love doing that, but at the same time, I'm trying to write. So I just finished a book on the death of dogs because, like you, Peter, I've been very attached to the dogs in my life. I don't think there's ever been a time when I haven't had a dog, except for now, because our dog is living in Berlin with our 22-year-old son. He's an ex-guide dog for the blind. He's now 14 years old. And he's starting to fail. So that got me thinking about the death of dogs. And I've just written a new book that's coming out soon, I hope, called Lost Companions, Grieving for Our Animal Friends. So I write my books now in between helping Lila see her patients. But I do not have the kind of energy that you have, Peter. I do not. And I admire it so much. I'm really in awe of you.
Well, as I said, I think I don't think that I deserve necessarily credit for having energy. It's like, you know, we're all born different in the same litter, you know. So, but thank you for appreciating that. Courage is another issue, and I don't know if we're born with a certain attitudes. I can track back to where some of my attitudes come from. But I remember very early being focused on what's true. I remember as a child saying to myself, when I grow up, I'm going to tell a truth about childhood. So I was thinking that way sometime around my early verbal years.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, Peter, because I think that's absolutely true. And it's one of the reasons that I wrote my most unpopular book of all called Against Therapy. And the reason I did that was not just because I realized that I myself was not a good therapist, and I was not claiming that nobody is. I think there are people who have a gift, who have empathy, who are good listeners, but I don't think it can be institutionalized. It can't be turned into a profession because you just don't know, you never know who's going to be good at it and who's going to be bad. And some people just have that touch. I remember very early on seeing an older psychoanalyst talking to a young child. He couldn't have been more than 6 or 7, and he was so empathic, and I could see he was really listening to that boy. He was not bored, and I thought, wow, I wish I could do that, but I don't have that gift. And then I discovered that many people who are in the profession do not have that.
Do not have it, that's right.
That led me to think, what was it? What is that? Can it be taught? And I discovered, or I believe I discovered, it cannot be taught. It is just like your energy, a gift. And we're fortunate if we find somebody like that. But my problem in writing the book Against Therapy was to ask people, how do you know that the person sitting across from you has that gift, or even if they have your interests at heart? It's not an easy thing to determine, and some people have definitely been helped by therapy, but others have been hurt.
Well, I think that book got me thinking a lot. I'd already been thinking that way, Jeff, because, you know, when I was at Harvard, I ran the beginnings of the Harvard Radcliffe Mental Hospital Volunteer Program. And one of the things that I did as the leader of it, I didn't originate it, but as the leader of it eventually, is I got the superintendent of the state hospital, with a little pushing by me as a college sophomore, to allow me to set up a program with a lovely social worker, Dave Cantor, supervising students, students from Harvard and Radcliffe once a week in a group. So it was very little of the time of the staff, and that we would each have our own patient. And I helped, I might have just plain old picked the people who went into the group. There were about 12, 15 of us. Who I knew through the volunteer program, which had hundreds of people coming through every year. And, you know, the president of the Boston Psychoanalytic Association, in one of my first clashes with the psychiatric authority, said we'd ruin the patients. I mean, these are state mental hospital patients. It's been in 10, 15 years, and the psychoanalyst from Boston is afraid we're going to ruin them. And he'd never even been in the hospital, I'm sure. Certainly never did any work there. And we ended up getting almost all the patients out of the hospital just by seeing them once a week and talking with them. And people had different approaches. Some were very empathic people. Some were very socially oriented people and would just take them out and be friends with them. And some people thought they were junior analysts. But everybody helped because everybody cared and was involved. So very early on, I knew it had nothing to do with training. And your book was very helpful to me in focusing on that even more. And one of my solutions, Jeff, is I have a training course now that people can find on my website that I did with the nutritionist, the woman who introduced me into good eating, Pam Popper. She has a health institute, and she's helped me at this age begin to do educational films. And one of the films is simply called The Heart of Being Helpful. And the whole idea, we just left everything about professionalism behind. The theme of it is, you know, you shouldn't license talk. And you have the right to help anybody you want in any kind of conversation you want. Just don't make claims that are untrue. Don't say you're a psychoanalyst when you're not. Don't say you're a trained therapist when you're not. You can say you took Peter Breggin's course if you want, if it's true. But this is some of the ways that people can help each other. So I've been moving so much in that direction. And I'm not going to pretend to license anybody in my work or anything, because I don't know how, as you said, to decide who's going to be a good therapist. And a lot of it takes experience.
That's right.
You really do have to learn something over the years on top of your empathy to deal with very, very upset people. So I learned very early on
that I simply could not do it. It was not something that I could do. I realized this was way beyond my capacity, but at the same time, I realized that what people were doing when I was in training in Toronto for 9 years, to become a psychoanalyst. I was not a psychiatrist, so they wanted me to go to visit various mental hospitals and see what happened there. And I was just appalled at what I saw. It was terrifying to me, especially electroshock. So this was in the 70s. They were using a lot of electroshock. And I had at one hospital, they said, "Do you speak Spanish?" And I said, "Yes, I do. I lived in Uruguay for some years." They said, "Good. We have a very, very upset patient, and he wants to talk to someone who speaks Spanish." And he told me they had given him electroshock. They were going to do it again. And for him, it was torture. And he begged me. He was crying. He was sobbing. "Tell them not to do it, please." And so I ran up to the psychiatrist, and I said, "You must not give this person electroshock. He's terrified of it." And the psychiatrist was a young Egyptian, and he said, "Look, I have no choice in the matter. I've been told I have to do it." I said, "But this is like torture to him. Please don't do it." And he insisted he was going to do it. And I said, "Well, then I'm leaving this hospital. I want nothing to do with it." And, you know, that's not even a question of knowledge. That's just ordinary human fellowship. When you see somebody suffering like that who does not want something done, you don't say, "This is for your own good." And this was before I discovered you, Peter, way before. And that's why I remember that person. And I think I told the story to this person in Paris, that you've got to get in touch with Peter Bregan. You are going to learn so much. And then I found your book about ECT, and it just opened a whole new world to me, Peter. It really did. And I realized how much you were doing then and continue to do against what you called brain-disabling so-called medications. And you were totally right, the worst of all being lobotomy, but ECT is pretty bad, and of course psychiatric medications. And I have never, to this day, never stopped believing that you were 100% right about all of those things. They are forms of torture.
Now, I think, Jeffrey, that one of the things you and I have in common, and probably most of my wonderful listening audience, I guess, folks, that you out there, who would, if you've listened to me more than once, that you share in this unwillingness to look away from the truth. That you just feel like people are supposed to see what's there. And every place that I have turned, and Jeffrey, every place you have turned, you have looked at the truth without any BS, without encumbrances. And I don't think it
That's
has
right.
a tremendous amount to do with intelligence either. And I think has zero. It's almost the opposite of education. I think that there are many people who simply aren't preoccupied with what somebody else says the truth is, and they evaluate it for themselves. They reason. They trust their own reason. They have no reason to doubt their own reasoning abilities. And I
well,
show
that's
psychiatry.
Right. And you know,
go ahead.
Well,
go ahead,
thinking
Jeff.
That when it comes to animals, having too much intelligence gets in the way of recognizing what they feel. That there were many, many scientists, zoologists, and biologists, and people who worked with animals who told me I was wrong about their emotional lives. And I thought, well, these people are far more intelligent than I am. They've done much more research. They've been around these animals all their lives. Could I be wrong? And then I decided that it was partly because they were so intelligent that they were not able to see a simple thing, such as when I said, "But dogs love us." And they said, "Oh, how can you hold that to be love? That cannot be love."
Oh, my gosh.
Peter, can you hear? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, I hear you. I hear you fine. Yeah, I know that some of my kids very early on had a better understanding of that than I did. I remember at one time one of my kids looked like they were going to jump into the street to grab our dog, who I didn't think was in danger, but it was a matter of opinion. And my child jumped in, wanted to jump in the street, and I said, no. And I pulled him back and the dog back, and I said, I don't want you to risk your life for the dog. And he said, what kind of person would I be if I didn't? And I remember, shame on me, I thought for a time about hunting. I've come a long way, Jeff. But I was going to, I know people who are hunters, and I'm not hostile to them at all. But not for me. I mean, I know people who hunt, and they believe in eating animals, and they eat meat, and they do it. But I was discussing with a different kid of mine about going hunting, and I was explaining that I might go out and hunt a rabbit. Well, this was like, what animal could I have picked that would be more upsetting to a normal child? And I said, but you know, honey, you shoot the animal and they really don't feel it. I don't know why I said something so stupid. And she looked at me and she said, I still don't think the rabbit would like it. This same daughter of mine, on a very early walk, I was stopped at a wooden telephone pole, and I was explaining to her, we were out in the suburbs, that this was a tree, that the tree had been cut down and shaped into this, and she looked at me and she said, where did the tree go? And
that's beautiful.
I think it was beyond me. It's still beyond me. So I don't think it's intelligence. I think it's a native desire to know the truth and to look for the truth and just not to believe what someone tells you, even if it's the father you adore. But to think in a certain way.
And I think that children have an enormous ability to do this, and it gets taken out of them through schooling and university, and eventually they lose that ability, but they start with it. That story you just told me, Peter, is amazing, because I recently have come to believe that trees and plants have far more life in them than we had given them credit for. So I would not be surprised if we don't eventually realize that they have feelings as well. There's a German writer by the name of Peter Wohlleben, and he's writing about the emotional lives of plants, and it's become a huge bestseller in Germany and all over, including the United States. And I think we're just catching up to this now. So I think that comment, I think he would love your daughter's comment about where is the tree now?
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because I love trees. I mean, it's a joke, and with Ginger and the people around me, I love birds and I love trees, and as well as the dogs. We got three dogs in the household. This is going far afield. I hope it's touching some of you wonderful folks out there, and maybe touching you in a way that gives you more confidence in your ability to know truths, to know things, regardless of what somebody else says, but just to know things. Some of the most highly educated people I know almost nothing about the most important things in life, particularly the importance of love. And as Jeffrey was saying, the whole psychological establishment didn't want to equate human beings and animals in any way. And then, of course, a huge part of the establishment now doesn't want to equate human beings with being human beings. The psychologists, so many of the academic people in the world want to think of us as reflexes and biological entities. And by the way, Jeff, I don't know if you knew this. I don't know if you and I have talked. We did 5 years ago. We talked we talked about animals in a more philosophic way. But Darwin felt very strongly that animals had feeling. He said, who could see a dog running in a field and not know that animals experience joy? Who could see a dog looking at you with love without thinking they're not experiencing love? And he went further and said, and I have watched dogs in difficult situations being pulled by two different things. For example, he hunted. He gave the example of a duck falls to the ground, and the dog thinks it's supposed to bring that duck in, and then something else distracts the duck, and the dog tries to make a choice between what he's supposed to do. And he really thought that dogs made moral choices as well. It was harder for him to talk about it or prove it. Darwin has been so abused, again, as part of this taking the life out of humanity. He's been so abused by the modern, biopsychological evolutionary people. I don't know if you were familiar with how Darwin viewed those things.
Yes, I did indeed. I wrote about it in When Elephants Weep because he was my first hero, even though I didn't agree with the fact that he still believed that one had to have vivisection, that you had to operate on dogs. But he and his children and his wife did not. I think they were correct about that, and he was wrong. But he really was the first person to write about this in a book he wrote in 1873. It was astonishing. It opened my eyes, and I started thinking about it and realized he was correct, but one had to go much further. So I credit Darwin with getting me involved. And I have to say, just ordinary people who I encountered, nobody was surprised. You know, that book, When Elephants Weep, The Emotional Lives of Animals, and Dogs Never Lie About Love, both of those together sold 2 million copies.
And they're wonderful books, folks.
The reason is because ordinary people realize that what I was saying was true. They weren't surprised as well. I've always known that animals have emotions. It was only the scientists whose job it was to do certain things to those animals who wanted to deny it. Ordinary people knew it. And I found that very impressive, that I was behind the times when it came to people who live with cats and dogs. Nobody who lives with an animal would ever deny that they have feelings.
I'll bet some of those scientists do live with animals, Jeff, and they've managed to deny that their animals have feelings. I think it has a lot to do with how one views oneself, because a lot of those scientists probably wonder if they have feelings, or what are feelings, or where do they come from. They may reject them. They may not feel comfortable about them. Jeff,
that's right. And I think ultimately...
Go ahead.
Ultimately, you and I talked about this on one program. It probably goes back to dividing everything into us and them, whether it's other people from different races or people who speak a different language or men and women, or humans and animals. We like to think of ourselves as special and others are different. And I think that's the ultimate problem. We have to get rid of this notion that there's an us and a them. That just about every living being on this planet is more similar than it is different.
Well, I think it's a wonderful concept, and I do think there's a lot of truth to it. I've not really thought hardly at all about this, although I should have after my daughter's remark when she was barely a toddler. I think she was still toddling. Where did the tree go? Why would I love trees so much? Why would I take such joy in trees? I'll tell you a funny story about optimism in life, about myself. When I was 65, which is nearly 20 years ago, I started to think I shouldn't plant any more trees. I'm not going to necessarily live to see them grow up and so on and so forth. And I'm 83 now, and I'm just planting trees again. I plant them for their own sake and for the sake of people to come, and probably from impulses I don't understand about the connectivity of life. I think that's very true.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad to hear that, Peter. I'm not a religious man, but if I had to choose a religion, I think it'd be the religion of trees. Because they're so majestic, they can live for thousands of years, and you know, I'm in awe. When I see a beautiful tree, it practically brings tears to my eyes. I don't know why. There's something about looking at a very beautiful, tall, majestic tree that makes me realize there's something in the universe more important than me. And I like that thought.
Yes. Yeah. That's so interesting. And at that moment, are you really feeling the tree is more important than you?
Yes, I do feel that, Peter. I've become increasingly convinced of my own unimportance. And I think this is a very difficult thing for anybody to realize, that we are, after all, here for a short time, we'll eventually die. We're not that important. So what is important? What is important is recognizing the importance of every other thing on this planet. That's what's so important.
Oh, I love that.
And it's very difficult to do.
I love that. And I think the good life.
I feel that we have to get together. We have to get together another time. I know I'm living in Australia, very far away from you. But I hope that either you or Ginger will come to Sydney, or Lila and I will come to visit you one day. We must get together. We are kindred souls. There are very few people who think in the way you do. And I love to hear you think. I mean, that comment you made, where did the tree go? That's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. Would you please tell your daughter from me? That is one of the most profound statements I've ever heard.
I will tell her today. I'll tell her to listen to the show, or suggest. I don't tell her anything. I suggest she listen to the show. That's lovely, Jeff. It is. It's very, very good to talk to you. It's wonderful. Well, let's get on the phone immediately after we hang up. And gosh, I just see a bird out on a feeder, and I don't know what it is. I think, it's a female Baltimore Oriole, or an immature. I think it's an immature Baltimore Oriole. How wonderful. Not quite ever seen that before, and I have Baltimore Orioles here. Let's get on the phone if we can and make another time. I'd like to have you back in the next few weeks, okay?
Lovely. I'd love to, Peter.
Wonderful. Yeah. There's so much we haven't touched on, folks. Our trip to Germany would be so interesting, to our response to being behind the Iron Curtain. I mean, how many people today have been behind the Iron Curtain and can talk about it? Another thing to talk about is psychiatry and the Holocaust. Another thing to talk about is therapy. Another thing to talk about is the animals more. Folks, I've always wanted to write a book with Jeff, but we've just never found a way to do it. We've thought about it a few times. That's interesting. But anyway, we've still got a few minutes left. Golly, I'm trying to think about what would be a very nice way to end. This idea that you just had was actually somewhat stunning in terms of the deepest message being to see the importance of so many other kinds of living beings and life rather than oneself. Is that close to it, Jeff?
Yes, I think that the necessity to get rid of our own private narcissism, you know, to not have to see the world just through our eyes, to try and do it through the eyes of a dog, the eyes of a patient, the eyes of somebody suffering, the eyes of trees, of flowers. I must say, Peter, like you, one of the great pleasures I have now in life is watching birds. And I just said to my wife yesterday, I would have moved to Australia for the parrots alone. Every morning, 30 or 40 rainbow lorikeets come onto my balcony and start screaming for me to come out and feed them with sunflower seeds. And it's just one of the great pleasures of my life. I love it. And I'm so pleased to hear that you feel the same way about birds. And Jonathan Franzen feels the same way, too.
Oh, ye God. Yeah, I mean, the one modification I made into our new home, which has about an acre of lawn and trees and a hill and a little creek behind it, little pond, little waterfall. One thing I did was I put in the largest window that could be shipped without getting special trucking or something, the largest window that could be shipped to us within codes, and put it in the wall of my office that faces the back balcony. And out my back balcony, I have three bird feeders hanging off the balcony. And then on the window itself, I have a little plastic feeder with bird seed in it, and I have a little feeder for the hummingbirds. So, I mean, I'm looking right now at five feeders. If I go to the balcony, I can see some more feeders, and I can see a whole bunch of birdhouses I've put up.
That is beautiful, Peter. I'm so glad to hear that. I wonder, you know, an interesting topic would be, what is the psychology of looking at birds? Why do we get so much pleasure from that? What is it that it's touching in us? And I'll bet you could write a beautiful piece on that, Peter. I for one, would love to read it.
Jeffrey, bless you. I know we don't have the same ideas about a God, but we're so close. And bless you with whatever force you believe in and is out there. And thank you, my wonderful audience. Thank you. I'm sure that many of you feel very close to the kinds of things we're talking about today. And check the frequent alerts, the free frequent alerts, for when I'm going to be having Jeffrey on again. I'm just going to look at my book, and we'll be having him on soon. Bye-bye, everybody. Goodbye. Bye-bye, Jeff.